Good morning, everybody. Happy Saturday. I know this is what you all want to be doing on a Saturday morning, right? Everybody. It's going to be an exciting day. I'm Hillary Drummond. I'm the president of BCSOT, and on behalf of BCSOT, I'd like you to welcome you to the joint BCSOT-COTBC AGM Day. I'm going to pass it over to Carol Williams. And
have a good day. Good morning, everybody. I'm Carol Williams, chair of the College of Occupational Therapists of BC, and I'd like to welcome you here today. And I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce our keynote speaker, Jan Robinson. Jan has over 17 years of experience in professional self-regulation. Her particular interests in regulation focus on professional competency, interprofessional collaboration practice, public performance, measurement and reporting, and the global movement of professionals. She is regularly asked to participate as a regulatory representative on committees and task forces within Canada and abroad. Jan has published in the area of professional competence and has conducted and published research related to barriers for access to professionals and on professional accountability. Jan is currently a board and executive committee member of the Canadian Alliance of Physiotherapy Regulators, an executive committee member of the Federation of Health Regulatory Colleges of Ontario, and past chair of the Ontario Regulators for Access, an interprofessional coalition interested in improving access to professions for internationally educated professionals. Known for her innovation and ability to build strong multi-stakeholder relations and partnership, Jan is a sought-after regulatory advisor and speaker provincially, nationally, and internationally. And I would like to welcome Jan Robinson.
Thanks, Carol, very much. Good morning to each of you. It's always interesting to hear yourself introduced, isn't it? Because when I really think about those kinds of things, I think what a lucky individual I am in terms of the journey that I've had and the mentors I've had along the way, the opportunities that have presented themselves that I've had the chance to take, and in some cases the courage to take, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, as well as the people that I've had the chance to join hands with and do interesting work with. So it's always reflective for me to hear that. It is an absolutely great pleasure to be here and to be with you, to be here in Vancouver. And I think one of the things that I get to say today that I haven't said in a really, really long time is that I am an occupational therapist. And that feels really terrific to me to be in a place where I can say that and feel like it's home. The interesting thing about professions that we all know, of course, is that they are about their culture and their traditions, and that feels very much like an embrace. And although as we move more and more into, and despite the fact that we've used team for years, more and more into the concepts of interprofessional collaboration and bumping up against those cultures and traditions, they are really a great pleasure in so many ways. So I am no longer a registered occupational therapist. But I am very much somebody who takes my roots with me. And I just want to talk about that for just a minute. Because when I think about my skill set and the competencies that I hope that I bring to what I'm doing now, and hopefully the ones that I'll grow as I continue to move through my career, I think about health policy, organizational leadership. I think about partnerships and collaborations and building networks. And all of that takes me back to my Occupational Therapy Foundation. So when I think about people and OT, I think about relationships. When I think about ideas and occupational therapy, I think about innovation. When I'm thinking about analysis, such a great skill that we all have, I think about strategy. And when I think about the solutions that is the very core being of what we're about, I think about outcomes. And I think about impact. And all of that is absolutely perfect for the kinds of things that I've taken with me along my road. So I'm absolutely very grateful and humbled to be here today. And I really want to thank the college for this invitation. So thank you, Carol. This is your celebration as a profession. This is 10 years of self-regulation in this particular province. And there is so much for you to celebrate in that regard. But before we go there, before we start to really talk about that, I'd really like to take you in a little bit of reflection because I'd like to make this on your Saturday morning, put you to work right away, for one thing. But on your Saturday morning, I'd really like you to be part of this conversation. I don't want this to be about me projecting in your direction. I'd really like to center you a bit in terms of your thinking about how you look at regulation as we begin this talk. So this is going to be a little bit of a challenge. I know that Mary Green and I went back and forth. We were thinking about all that wonderful technology, you know, the little clickers where everybody clicks and all the stuff comes across the screen. So I'm going to have to pretend to be that, so that's okay. But what I thought that I would do is put out to you four thoughtful questions. I don't want you to think on them too long. And we'll do this by individual standing just to demonstrate where you sit. Now, this is always a tricky thing to do as a regulator, right? Because it means a commitment. It means saying, okay, are they out there taking down names of who stood for what particular element? But I can assure you that that isn't the name of the game here. It's really more to get a temperature read, because I'd like to weave it into my talk. So I'd like you to really be honest, because that's one of those things that's just helpful in terms of how we think about where we're going and where we get to the end of this conversation. And because we have one component of this where I'm going to ask for your thoughts, and because we're recording, and in this particular section there are really two mics and I'm just looking for spontaneity, what I'll do is I'll repeat in this section of our time together, I'll just repeat it back. So I'm hopeful that that will be all right. Okay, so the first reflective thing that I'd like you just to think on is just for yourself. No comparing notes, no joining hands with your neighbor for the sake of strength. Is do you believe that your college is known as a regulatory leader in this province? Okay, so do you believe that your college is known as a regulatory leader in this province? So we're doing the scale of 1 to 10. 0 would be you don't know. You just really don't know, one way or the other. 5 would be possibly. And 10 would be absolutely yes, they are. Okay? Everybody clear? Okay, so what I'm going to ask you to do, we'll do it in little groupings. So of those who really don't know one way or the other, which is totally fine, let's say you've given a score on 1 to 10, somewhere between 0 and 3. Anybody that would stand and say that you just really don't know? Okay, can you just stand? Okay, so a few. Great. Fabulous. Those of you who think possibly they are, so that would be, let's say, that on the scale between 4 and 7, possibly. Terrific. Thank you. And those who would say on the 7 to 10, yes, you think they're in the yes category. Fabulous. Okay, so that's certainly in the majority, but there's obviously some rocks unturned here, so that's an interesting thing. Okay, let's go to the next one. We're twisting it just a little bit differently here, okay? So do you view, personally, a regulatory organization as being able to position the profession in the health system? Do you view a regulatory organization as being able to position the profession in the health system? So we're going with the same scale again, sort of. So 0 is no. You don't think the regulator really has a role in positioning the health profession in the health system. 5 is maybe. And 10 is, yes, that you do think that regulation has a place to play in terms of positioning in the health system. Okay, people are clear? Doing the same thing again, we're going to stand. So those of you who think the regulator doesn't, a regulatory organization, I'm not talking about this one, but a regulatory organization doesn't have a role in positioning the profession, let's go on the 0 to 3. All right. Those of you who think that sometimes it probably does have a role in positioning the health profession. Okay, super. And those of you who do believe that a regulatory organization has a role in positioning. Very strong. Interesting. Okay. So that was interesting for those of you who didn't capture, because we've obviously got a poll in the way here too, is that really there isn't anybody really sitting too much on the level of no, there's no role, but some differences of thinking related to what that role could be. Interesting. Okay, now this one's going to take you just a little bit longer. And what I want to talk to you about right now is the whole concept of public confidence. So public confidence. What does public confidence look like to you? So if you're thinking about a confident public or a confident public in occupational therapy, they're confident around occupational therapy or occupational therapists. What does that look like? So I'm just looking for descriptors. Okay, so just think for a minute about that. And then I'm just going to ask you to shout it out, but I'll repeat it back. What we're talking about here is, what does public confidence look like to you? So when you're thinking about a public who is confident in the occupational therapist or occupational therapy they're receiving, what does it look like to you, just in your own words? Anybody prepared to start?
Informed.
Informed, okay.
Engaged.
Trust.
Integrity,
sorry. Accountable, great.
Safe.
Safe, perfect. Anything else come to mind?
Competent.
You guys are great for Saturday, cheapers. Ethical, super.
Knowledgeable.
Useful. What a great word. That's a great word. Okay, superb. Thank you. Now, I'm going to ask you a different question. So you heard all of those words? So we're back to the scale of 1 to 10. Do you think in the province of British Columbia that you've achieved public confidence? So 0 is no, 5 is somewhat, 10 is absolutely. So those of you on the 0 to 3, no, we don't think we're there yet in terms of public confidence in occupational therapy in British Columbia. Anyone prepared to stick their neck out on that? Okay. Those who believe that you've somewhat achieved public confidence, so that would be 4 to 7. Okay. Super. And those of you who think that you're really almost right on the money in terms of public confidence, between 7 and 10. Okay. Fantastic. You guys are great. So you're in the middle of the story now in terms of your reflections related to this. So let's go back to this celebrating 10 years, and we'll weave some of these thoughts in over my talk. So what a journey you've been on. What a journey you've been on. And I wanted to depict this in kind of a fun way. And Carol, actually, you spoke about this last night in your speech and your toast related to the celebration. So here we've got a series of billboards of the kinds of things that have been really solid in the middle of this 10-year story. So governance excellence, you have a board of 9. You've got 3 public members. You have public voice on your board of directors related to the college. And they've been really striving to stay centered on the public interest in relationship to the conversation in the profession. You've seen registrant growth over the last 10 years of 34%. That's just not about Canadian occupational therapists. That's about internationally educated occupational therapists as well. And BC being the second largest entry point over Ontario. So really a fantastic growth ratio over that period. Continuing competence program. You've launched and been discussing continuing competency and quality assurance for a number of years now, and you've got some really fantastic tools that are becoming models related to what could be out there around the science of quality assurance and continuing competence. You're a partnership-based group. We're talking about partnerships related to the academic community. We're talking about partnerships with the association, obvious by meeting here today, for example, and partnerships with occupational therapists in this province. Become involved with government policy work, in particular in the area of health human resource planning, workforce planning in the province of British Columbia. Interprofessional collaboration, active player in the regulatory community here in the province, holding hands in that regard, which is really an important area. And you even demonstrate that with your offices, where you share your office space with another regulatory colleague. And so some really interesting modeling around IPC. And then the national and the international stage. Very much this college here has taken a lead and been involved in supporting and promoting the Association of Canadian Occupational Therapy Regulatory Organizations, so more fondly known as ACOTRO. But this is not a group that's incorporated. It's a group that supports itself and keeps itself moving by the very nature of the work that they're choosing to do together that has been important in terms of labor mobility across this country. And the global movement of the profession as well, so talking a little bit about where we headed on the international stage. So lots of wonderful things that really come down to one word, which is really about leadership. And when we're talking about the regulatory community, just like any other community, and you know this as well as I do, that really in any community there are only a handful of great leaders. And you are so fortunate to have one of them within your particular community here. And I'd really want to stop just for a moment to acknowledge Kathy Corbett, who is really known across the country for leadership in the area of regulation. And I'd like us all to give her a round of applause. So I really salute Kathy, but the thing that leadership comes down to that's so important, and it's important for all organizations, but in particular organizations entrusted with a public mission, is the whole concept of integrity, because without it, your commitment to public protection is not able to earn the confidence that you'd like to earn. We were talking about confidence a few moments ago. We've been talking about celebration. We've been talking about the milestones. We've been talking about all of the wonderful things that we can pat ourselves on the back around, which is important. But I really want to come and say to you today, so what? So what? And this really brings me back to my presentation title, which is about strategic instrument or archaic Leviathan. Now, I can't tell you how many people keep asking me, why'd you pick Leviathan? And there's really much more romantic reason for it than people would believe. But anyway, my grandfather actually was a writer. He did many things, but one of the things that he did was write. And he enjoyed poetry. And he was from the East Coast. And one of the things on the East Coast, of course, is there's really not a lot that we would call mountains, particularly out here. But for them, Blomidon, that moves into the middle of the Bay of Fundy, was considered a Leviathan. He wrote a poem about, and it stuck in my mind over the years, and I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to use that word. So there we go. So Leviathan it is. But what I'm really looking at, when you look at legislation, and I'm sure that many of you can remember as you move towards regulation 10 years or so ago, there's fear around that because it is a big thing. And when we're looking at something like the Matterhorn, as beautiful as it is, it's like legislation. It's solid, it's rock, it's not very movable. It really is kind of etched in time, and you kind of feel like you got to work your way around it. And it's central, and it's part of the economy, and it's about things that we can't really control because it's sitting right there. And it might also look like this. The other view, often, of regulation is this whole rules-bound piece, which is about being constrained, being about being in a box, not being very open. From our side, of course, it feels pretty safe and pretty protected. But this is the other option, right? This is the outside view in. But perhaps it's a different view around the rock. Perhaps it's a different view. Perhaps it's about exploring options and directions and possibilities. Perhaps it's another view, which is about all of the colors that are possible on a canvas that is yet to be painted or yet to be imagined on where we can go on innovation. And therein lies the conundrum of the regulatory community, which is about this concept of the rock, the solid part, the rules part, and the possibility part. So it's important to take time to pause because reflections need to be despite accomplishments, in spite of mandate. They need to be large, they need to be broad, they need to be bold, and they need to be beyond the profession. And so perhaps the kinds of questions that we're asking ourselves in 10 years' time out from the beginning is, are we still on the right path? Are we still on the right path? Did we get it right? Are we still aligned with our mission? Have we drifted? Are we using our own data to make mid-course corrections? So if we get slightly off center, how are we getting back into the middle? Are there things that we should not continue to do just because we're doing them? Does that mean we should continue to? And so becomes the question, what kind of journey do we want to be on for the next 10 years? So there are a few reminders in here that I just wanted to put as placeholders in this conversation. And one of them is this, reminding ourselves consistently and constantly that this is a public organization entrusted to a profession. It means it's a privilege. It means it can go away. And it's very difficult, particularly for individuals who aren't actively involved in college activity in an ongoing way, to remind ourselves that it is not a professional organization. It doesn't mean it's not professional, but you know what I mean. And the concept of that is because we look at the organizations to which we pay money, to which we belong, to which we think about occupational therapy as profession-based organizations. It's just a logical way to go. But this is not a profession-based organization. This is one entrusted to a profession, and it is accountable to the government. It is accountable to the Minister of Health, and through that, the public. The members are not in that equation. Which doesn't mean the voice isn't important, and I'll come back to voice, but really important to stay rooted in it's a public organization. Which means that as a college, it needs to consistently ask itself, are we right-minded in our thinking? What's the same? What's changed? Where's the government going? What do we need to be considering? Which becomes, are we advancing a new normal, or are we staying anchored? Do we prefer the comfort of the rules and the rock? Or are we prepared to stretch to say, what are the possibilities about our contribution in this business of regulation? This is a challenge that I really put out to all of us, because as a profession, are we courageous self-leaders in the middle of the whole story? The college is not its address. The college is not its CEO, as marvelous as she is. The college is not its board, as marvelous as the board is. The college is the profession. And through that becomes the question of, is the profession a passenger in this discussion on self-regulation and the next missions and where things are going? Or is your voice, are you choosing to be a passenger, or are you choosing to use your voice as a majority of one in terms of describing and contributing to the thinking related to where it's going? And in those choices, are those choices about inspiring public confidence? You guys were brilliant in your ability to come up with words, single words even. I wasn't even counting on that particularly, but loads of single words that were saying this is what public confidence would look like. It's a hard thing, and it's a very hard thing to measure. But should we not be aspiring to it as a profession? Because it's about people, and it's about the people that we serve. And so what does that look like? Now, I want to focus in another anchor for a moment, which I'm going to touch on this a couple of times, actually, in my talk, the importance of the different roles of associations and regulators. And I can tell you that there are many organizations that do not get this, do not get this. And this is a very important point on asking some really tough questions, particularly on the regulatory side. There's more wiggle room on the association side. There's less wiggle room on a regulatory side. Because the slippery slope of moving your conversation from public discourse and public interest into the conversation on how to promote or how to facilitate the work of the profession lands smack in the middle of the question of integrity. And I would suggest to you that reality has no place in any of this. Perception is the only thing. And so in that event, one needs to be very careful about how the discourse and the conversation between the association and the regulatory body exists, because that helps one another in their understanding and therefore their appreciation of difference and their ability to set their mission and their goals separately but collaboratively with the broader outcomes of the profession as a whole. So in our difference as a regulator, one of the things that is really important, again, for a profession to remember, because remember I was talking about the entrusting part, you know, that we're it's an organization entrusted to a profession. It comes back to this concept of social contract. And I'm not going to give you a little history lesson related to this, but social contracts really began with the trade guilds back in Roman times, so eons ago. But modern social contract activity really started in the late 1800s and took off exponentially from the 50s onward. What's happened quite a bit, though, is that certainly over the 80s and 90s, the traditional social contract, which was government to profession, has really been shifted up with conversation of how business infiltrates government decision-making. And now, of course, we could all say how public voice is shifting the discussions on the social contract as well. But regardless, when we think about social contract and we think about a mission of a college, these things up here on the screen, this is what we're about. We don't have the whole slice of the public interest. I mean, that's a pretty big pie. We get this little slice on entry. Who gets in? Conduct. How do we deal with the people that are out of line? Quality assurance. How do we make sure that we're saying that we can say confidently to a public that this profession meets the standards of practice and setting then standards of practice for the profession? This is our piece. And what I'm here to suggest to you as well is if we don't do it well, there's zero room for strategy. Zero. Public expectation is that we're doing that stuff well. I'd also suggest to you if we're not doing entry to practice well and we're not doing professional conduct well, public's not even going to care about continuing competence either, because it just means we're letting everybody in who shouldn't be here and we're not taking care of people that really need to be remediated. So beyond that, there's a lot of interesting challenges in this conversation about what our business is related to regulation. So that brings us to, let's pretend we are doing everything really well on the stuff that we're expected to do well. Then we always have to maintain and keep that up. So at best, a regulatory organization has 10 to 15% of its time to play in the sandbox. And then, of course, it gets to decide what it's doing to advance the discussion within that. So then it becomes important to ask in that sandbox opportunity, how are we going to make a difference? How is the profession going to contribute to the business of self-regulation in 2010? And how is the profession contributing to the business of public protection in the future? What's it going to look like? These are the strategic conversations that I think that regulators need to be having, not insularly, but they need to be having. And these are the areas for regulatory impact. Good to great, many of you probably have seen Jim Collins' work, but I think this is really a poignant point, and this is really where I'm going to go with the next bit of my presentation. Leadership is not about the vision. We all have lovely vision statements. Many of us can recite them. It's not about that. It's about the fact that do we take in time, and I started with the concept of pause, do we take time to go backwards and take a look at facts, real data, and then act on the implications of them? Are we courageous enough to do that? The concept and the deep concept here is that a story does not make it right. It just means it's a story. And it just happens to be the stories that I've lived through related to the more current times in terms of regulation in my world, which at this moment in time happens to be physical therapy. But these stories are about regulation, not necessarily about a profession. So the challenge of the regulator constantly is this lovely little thing on carrots and sticks. And the thing is that most people out there expect it to be a stick. So they expect whatever the regulator's putting out is going to have some consequence somewhere along the line. And even when you put out a carrot, they figure that the stick's hidden. So it doesn't really much matter. You're just trying to figure that out in the middle of the carrots and the sticks, which makes it challenge because it comes back to this conversation of real or perceived. And what I really believe about this, because what we're talking about on reality and perception and carrots and sticks is about engagement. And self-regulation, no matter which profession we're discussing, is only as good as the engagement of the profession in the movement forward of public protection. So here are some of my stories in relationship to my current organization around this. So we've worked really hard to position the quality story related to the profession as a partnership. And I'll tell you why a little bit about this. So in Ontario, we have a mandate to set a quality assurance program, and we have a mandate to develop a continuing competence strategy as well. Very typically the same thing that you have here in British Columbia. So our mandate's been around, well, the mandate of the particular college I'm with has been around since the 50s, but the quality assurance mandate has been around since the early 90s. And because it was fairly revolutionary at the time, we really struggled with what's that going to look like, how's it going to evolve, and every profession was trying to figure out its own place in this. What ended up happening in the physiotherapy community were there were lots of great initiatives that got put together, but they didn't hang together in any kind of structure, in any kind of way that the profession itself could make sense of it. So it was quite splintered, and that created an increasing amount of angst and discomfort for the profession as a whole because they just didn't get it. They just didn't get how this was going to assist them other than impact them. And so what we did was we shifted that up in the early 2000s by changing the program, but it was interesting at the time, it all made sense at the time, everything makes sense at the time, right? We put a tagline on this, on quality, it's up to you. Now what we didn't do is we didn't think about that as ready, aim, fire, which is really what it turned out to be, because we launched the program and the program had acceptance generally, but it was still that feeling of we're coming out and we're going to find you someplace. So we switched that all up to a partner's message. And I can tell you we didn't change one thing about the program, not one thing about the structure of the program, but we changed the language. And you'll hear me come back to language quite a bit. And we went from quality, it's up to you, to partners in quality care, and all of the noise went away, 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 away. And we ended up with huge engagement. And I can tell you the engagement wave has continued since that time, which is 2007. And what we started to see when we first made those language changes, so at this point in time, there would have been about 5,600 PTs that would have been actively engaged in the quality assurance program. When we relaunched, we had over 3,000 individuals involved in webcasts related to the topic and the conversation. We introduced our online tools. Now, this is another interesting little trick. I really don't want to do anything that would cause people to understand the backroom discussions on this kind of stuff. But the truth is, for example, and now because of technology, it's a whole different ballgame, but when we launched our self-assessment tools, because they were paper and pencil or you could download them, we didn't know whether people were doing them until we went out to do self-assessment stuff, and we're only doing 5% of the population at any point in time. So technically, who knew? Anyway, we launched it online, though, where in aggregate we knew who was completing it. And within 3 months, which we had an 8-month window for people to complete it, within 3 months we had 98% activity. Okay, so it's kind of amazing. What I mean about the reflective learning evident in submissions, so when an individual receives their report from an assessor, because we do on-site practice assessment, and we were really trying to reduce the fear, so we kept changing, as I said, the language related to what we were using. And what we started to see naturally was the change in how people were reflecting on their learning out of assessments, and they were writing these marvelous, almost like essays, on how they had utilized that information and altered their practice. Really fabulous examples that we can use as data to demonstrate where things are going. And probably, I would save to say, if we're not the only one, we're pretty close to the only one, we all of a sudden had an upsweep of individuals who wanted to volunteer for their on-site assessment. So every year we have people who volunteer, which is really terrific. Another story, creating evidence-informed policy with influence. Now, developing policy has got some fairly deliberate processes in it, partly because government expects them, but partly because you need to be quite methodical about how you're putting your policy at the table for debate by your board. But do you know what? We've been really, really bad at internal navel-gazing on policy. And generally what you see is either you've got an organization that's taking its evidence from related to the profession on its own, or it might move out to a profession across a nation. It does not often move outside to what other professions are doing within health. But I would suggest to you that that's not big enough at all. This really needs to be looking at the fact that regulation is in the middle of the economics, health, human resources. In the middle of the economics of government policy making, of decision making. And so when we're really thinking about how do we set our standards, how do we look at the way in which we want to use competency, we're really talking about, are we thinking about the Competition Bureau? What's going down with the Department of Foreign Affairs? What's happening with the Ministry of Citizenship and Immigration? What's happening with the whole health promotion movement? Like there's a plethora of other things that we need to be considering beyond what we typically think about when we're setting policy. So this is one about looking at outcomes that are going to last and making sure that there is evidence-informed and as broad and as big as you can go to really challenge yourself. Here's another one, emphasizing transparency and inclusion at early intervals. Now, I would suggest to you that the average regulatory process, and I was in a meeting, we were talking about this yesterday actually, believes that we're transparent because we have accountability mechanisms where we have to send things out, right, for feedback. And generally, when we do that, it's a pretty well-formed document that then goes out for commentary, right? And people have their voice and comes back and off we go. I would suggest to you that that is not transparency. And we've really struggled with what does that look like and how do we evolve it and where can we take the concept of transparency in the work of regulation. So let me just share some of our stories as ideas. So we launched 2 years ago something called the Physiotherapist Partners Network. We weren't sure what the uptake was going to be on this, but this was the concept of having a group of individuals who we could call on at any point in time with a particular question, and we would have the demographics on them, so we could either slice it and dice it by demographics or just put out a general call. And the aim here was to take out early questions, like, we're looking at launching our communication strategy at point of care. We'd like to know about what you think the pinch points might be on that. We are looking at moving to putting our portfolio in this kind of a way online in order to combine it with learning goals, etc. Where do you think the profession is going to sit on some of those concerns? Other than the voyeuristic side of every profession, people are anxious about professional conduct numbers. You know, what are the complaints numbers and what does this all look like? And they believe that it's this big hidden box. So we had a whole conversation with the profession in this way about how do we demystify this a bit? What would you suggest to us? So this is a group that we started off with saying, okay, you know what, we're going to just ask for 50. Because we don't really think we're going to get a large group on this. Anyway, within 2 days, we had over 100. So we stopped it at 100, and then we replace 50 every year. And it's a wonderful way of getting early on input related to our work. Our council, in the middle of its council meetings, will stop its meeting and host for 45 minutes an open forum through WebEx with interested physiotherapists to come online and chat with them about decision-making at the council table and the issues that they have of the day. And so this is just a growing thing, but at our last council meeting, we had 120 sites online at the time. So it's interesting. It has some risks to it, but it's interesting. We're using a quality management blog at the moment, and I have to tell you the whole social networking piece and regulation is very, very difficult, partly because if you leave it really wide open and you've got people who are really off course, you kind of have to parachute in as Big Brother and say, stop that right now because that doesn't make any sense. So, and that's a problem. So you don't want to inappropriately use the power of a regulator in that way. So the quality management blog that we're using right now is we're trying to change the language of continuing competence, and we know we're way out here and we want to bring the professional along. So we're using it as a mediated blog to throw out questions where we can gradually put the language changes in that gradually inch them a little closer to where we want to get to. We also want to change the conversation with safety champions in the whole safety system. So we are deliberate about wanting to say, look, we know that physiotherapists, and I know this is the same for OTs, safety on an individual care basis, significant in terms of what people are about. Talking about systems, though, very different. So we're being deliberate about that, and we've built a network of safety champions to start to help move this initiative forward. And those are early on days, so we consult with them about all of our strategy. And it's turning out to be quite a good thing. So again, early involvement, transparency. Championing interprofessional collaboration. Now, here is a fascinating little piece. British Columbia and Ontario both bravely walked into the bold new world and decided we needed to write in stone into the legislation, we're back to the little Leviathan, in stone that colleges need to talk together and we have to help our professions talk together. So now that's in law, which is just a lovely little thing when you think about it, that we had to be told to talk. Anyway, regardless, this is where we are in terms of championing this. Now, regulators are really lousy at it. Do we get together? Yes. You've got the Health Regulatory Organizations of BC, and we call it a federation in Ontario. So groups come together. But, you know, this is one of those things that we come together and we listen, and then we agree to disagree and we go home. And this is not helpful. And where you've started to see the change is you'll start to see it on rules and you'll see it on risk. So, for example, a latest example in Ontario would be pharmacy and docs working together to come out with some directions related to the use of opioids. But that's a high-risk area, and the government's right on their back around it. So that would be an example. Another example around rules, you guys have a delegation mechanism as well. Very easy to come together around a rule because, again, it's enshrined in that lovely rock, so we need to deal with it. Standards, not so easy. Not so easy. And I really think that this is one of those areas where we need to have some real conversation around. Because I'll give you an example. If you were the average member of the public, which you are, actually, but if you're, now that I think about it, anyway, an average member of the public, if they actually knew that there are 20-some-odd regulated health professions and 20-some-odd standards on record-keeping, don't you think that would blow them out of the water? I mean, it's one of those things that feels really super odd. I'll give you another example. We recently are going out with our clinical education standard, which we are shifting up to call supervision of student learners. And part of the reason for that is to be able to loosen up the conversation on supervising students of other professions. So not interprofessional supervision, but beyond, so that we can look at the interprofessional education movement. We shared that thinking that of those that are commonplace that we work with, we might be in a place where we could say, like, how could we look at a combined standard so that point of care, people aren't confused and can't say, well, my college says. But zero ability to uptake. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. And I am so delighted, and I told her this last night. This has got to be like 20-some-odd years ago I heard this phrase. I use it all the time. But I believe that occupational therapy is really positioned to take up the gauntlet on this particular one. Sue's in the crowd here, Sue Baptiste. This is a phrase she used. But I think, based on the skill set of the profession, that's about the kinds of things that I talked about that I'm carrying with me on my own journey, relationships, strategy. These are things that we're really good about. Process. That's what's needed to move this standards discussion forward. So I ask you, are you leading? Are you leading? So striving to demonstrate public confidence, we've been talking about public confidence on and off here. And my organization really took, in 2004, a real focused look at the whole area of accountability and where are we headed with the accountability story. And it's really a challenge to demonstrate. And this is one of those things I would suggest where doing the right thing is worth not doing it well to begin with. So it's fine to do it imperfectly in order to start to move forward. And we've done a number of things. So here we have language. And language comes back again. Do we sound like an association or do we sound like a regulatory organization? We have public interest cards at our council table in terms of how we look at, are we getting off center or are we staying on center? Another example is, and I can tell you, my director of communications not terribly happy with me. It took us 2 years to come up with the slogan that we were going to use for our communication strategy. And partly that's because they all sound way too sexy for regulation. And they're much better used in association life. It's very difficult. But do you know where we got to? My title, Your Protection. And that's really what it's about. But it was painful. It was a painful little process. But really, really difficult. What's the language we're using? Indicators. This is how do we decide what we're going to measure? So we're using a balanced scorecard, and I had the chance to share a little bit with your board here around our work around balanced scorecard. But heck, you know what? There are a lot of markers in the legislation that say we should be doing X. If we can't tell the public that we're meeting our mandate, what are we telling them on the public confidence side of life? And then we come back to courage about whether or not we're being a passenger or whether we're willing to stand up and have a majority voice of one and say, you know what? Here's where we're screwing up. And here's where we need to learn, and we need to get better at doing that publicly, which we're not very good at. Because I would suggest to you that is about confidence for sure. So what have we been talking about? We've been talking about impact, power. We've been talking about focus in words like partnering, creating, championing, striving, positioning. So what does a new, bold regulatory culture embrace? Okay, an improvement culture. An improvement culture. But this isn't just about occupational therapists, you know, and what they're doing in relationship to meeting a mandate underneath the Health Professions Act. This is about what's that organization doing around improvement? What's its improvement culture? Where are its indicators and its learnings? Are we walking the talk? Are we still talking about incompetency? You know what? The literature doesn't support that at all. The concept of incompetence related to an improvement culture is practice drift. What are we doing around engaging a profession related to a conversation about how it keeps itself current? What are we doing with our sole practice individuals? How are we assisting those in rural practice? How do we assist conversation? Because that's the dialogue that assists with practice drift. So engagement. Collective standards. This, I would suggest to you, and this is a difficult, difficult thing for professions, because what did I start with? I started with culture and how we embrace it and how important it is. And titles are important to people. But the fact is, the public doesn't care. So we need to kind of get over that and use the culture and the title piece in a different way. And we need to really be considering not so much our differences and our prowess around this, but what are the competencies that we bring to the table? And what's the buffet that we're offering in relationship to what we bring? And how are we nimble in how we contribute to a system? And how is it, as I come back again to say, how is it that this profession is using its skill set to really assist the conversation on collective standards? A research agenda. Jeepers creepers. Regulators are a fountain of data-rich source. Are we using it enough internally? Do we ask ourselves good questions about that data and what it means to public protection? Do we use that data at all to talk cross-college to see what we can learn so that we can have an impact on where regulation is going to assist the health system? How do we contribute in this way? Resources on safe care. Now, I'm not suggesting that regulators need to become the ultimate source for this, because that's not realistic or possible. But regulators have a responsibility in the quality story to be talking about how are they providing resources and linkages to the concepts of safety, and how is it that we stretch the voice and have people really hear the patient voice related to patient safety, and how do we make sure we're thinking about systems? How do we make sure we're thinking about systems? And where is occupational therapy in the setting of policy related to safety at a government level? And last but not least, these all come together to talk about the data and voice and helping to shape government strategy. Remember, this is a public organization. Where's the minister going? Be a wise player and be an evidence-based player. So, here we are again, regulation. So when we started off, do you think it's rules-bound? Do you think it's boring? Do you think it's insular? Well, I really would challenge you to say I think the opportunity is infinite. And I think it is absolutely an imperative to engage all partners actively but appropriately in the discussion on public protection and where we're moving. This does not mean, and this is one of the things, everybody can't be a leader all the time. There's lots and lots of different ways to lead. But it is important for collaboratives related to associations, regulators, academics, others, really being smart about where does the profession need to go in the name of patient care related to the system as a whole, and how is it that we play together in a really big sandbox, knowing that sometimes you get to be it and sometimes I do. And so we consider, are you building a clock or are you telling time? Are you about a moment or are you about a solid foundation? And I'm suggesting you've got to, in regulation, preserve the core, but you want to stimulate progress as well. And you want to take breaks from time to time and re-energize. So make your goals audacious. Think really big. Think courageous leadership. And make your work compel you to aim for greatness. Make your work compel you to aim for greatness. The profession's obligation is to responsibly self-regulate. That's its obligation. The profession's opportunity is to view regulation as a strategic instrument in the conversation on quality, safe care. So congratulations to all of you and in the profession in British Columbia for a courageous 10 years of regulatory leadership. And I have something I actually want to give you, Carol, if you could come up this way. So I have a little plaque for the office that just says Promoting Regulatory Leadership 2000 to 2010, College of Occupational Therapists of British Columbia. Congratulations.
Well, isn't that lovely? Thank you.
So what I thought that we could do now is, if we wanted to, we can field some questions. And then I have three areas of dialogue that I want to throw out to tables that we'll gather up and have some broader conversation about as well. I don't know if there are questions that people have or...
I'll go back and...
Okay, you go ahead. Any reactions at all? Yes. Actually, would you mind going to the mic? Would that be all right? Thank you so much.
Sorry, I have a question about being smart about dealing with government. I could be naive about this, but seemingly to me, government has a very short-term view and thinks about four-year election cycles. So how does that impact on us taking a long-term view?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'd answer it a couple of ways. I think when I'm thinking about being smart, we're going to have a longer-term view related to the profession itself and where its contribution can go. But the reality is that healthcare is about money, and the government gets to decide how it's going to spend it, and it is about an election cycle. So it's about putting the realities of what we know, about what we can contribute, but mapping them against the reality of that. Because to consistently fight against it and to be defensive in that regard isn't going to then get you very far. So really understanding, having a profession-based understanding of where you want to move, and then mapping against it, where have you got a government wanting to go, and saying, you know what, I'd really like to be talking about grapes. I really want to talk about grapes. They want to talk about apples. So I'm going to start the conversation on apples because I then can maybe move it towards bananas, and then bananas will eventually get to grapes. Do you see what I'm saying? So the thing is that, but if you insist on constantly wanting to go in to talk about grapes and they want to talk about apples, that's always where you're going to be. So I think that being smart about how you look at it is accepting the realities of what government is about and what they believe public voice is about, but using your insight and your knowledge related to the profession and where you believe patient care to go to say, I need to accept the increments around that and let me see how I shape it. Let me just say it one other way. Let's say all they want to hear is apples, but you know that you can have a role in apples as well. Better to get on the table and talk about apples, because what's going to happen is there'll be opportunities that'll come out of that. One of the things that I practice very much and still do, is that I often get involved in things I know zip about, or that I know that, hopefully it's not the entire business of regulation, but that I know very little about, that I know my organization's going to need to know about, that I know we're going to need to know about. Sometimes I lead that stuff because it's easier to lead and then orchestrate how the conversation goes than it is to necessarily sit at the table and really still have no knowledge. And what happens, I often find out of that, is that people, one, they see the visibility. They know that you're there. They know you're interested in the conversation, and they ask you to do other things. And, for example, in the interprofessional care movement in Ontario, the government was really taking off. We made sure that we were invited to their opening vision exercise around that. I made a point of asking three questions at that meeting. And what was interesting about that, and I'm not going to say it's the only thing, but what happened for me, and I remember because I was sitting on a dock up north, I got a call from the Assistant Deputy Minister's office, and they called to ask me to lead the regulation component of their work they wanted to do around IPC. Now, did I have the foggiest clue where that was going? I didn't. But I took it because I knew it was an opportunity. And that led me to sitting on the Strategic Implementation Committee for the province and has led to some research and some other kinds of things that have led the regulation movement forward. So I'm just, all I'm really saying about that is there will always be a mismatch, in my opinion, between where a profession believes it needs to be and where it believes patient care needs to be and where the government's going to take it. But the smart choice in my mind is to figure out how you play in the middle. How you play in the middle. Does that help a bit? Other questions?
That was excellent, Jan. I'm intrigued by your open forum during your council meetings and just curious to know how that kind of got initiated. And I'm sure your response wasn't fabulous right off the get-go, but just kind of the process involved in that coming to be.
Thank you for that. Part of this was a dialogue in partnership with my president, but also with the executive committee, around the fact that very often in the broader community, because the registrar is often the face of conversation, that the board often falls to the background of people's front of mind as the actual decision makers. People forget that there's a board of directors making decisions. And so we were talking about what would be some of the ways that we could increase the visibility of the board as the decision maker. And so this was one of them. This is what came to pass. So what we did was set it up. We started it off as a half an hour only, and we always set a topic. We try to set a topic that we know will be not so much pithy, because it's not a long period of time, but at least engage people in, oh, I want to know about that. And that part of the presentation is no more than 10 minutes. And gradually, more and more, it's catching hold. I would say we started with maybe 25, 30 sites very initially, and it's just growing steadily over time. So we're staying patient with it. And initially, when we started, like, nobody would ask a question. Like, who wants to risk putting their question in the middle of the college board table? And so it was pretty silent. And so for a couple of them, we staged some questions to try and get some things going. So we knew who was participating, and then we said, can we work with you guys to come up with some questions? And then it's kind of taken off from there. Does that help a bit, Heather? Okay. What we were looking to do is I really have three areas that I'd like you to think about at your tables and have some conversation around. And we're going to start with one. And so what I'd like you to do is have some conversation as you reflect on what I had to say and what's running through your mind about the presentation. Think about what resonated and why it resonated for you. So share that with your group, and then I'd like you to pick one of those that you'll report out on. Okay. So I'm going to give you 5-10 minutes, okay, just talk about something that resonated and why, and then pick one among those. And if you're at a really small table, you might want to join with another so your conversation is richer. Okay. The question that I put out to you in this first go-round was, in the presentation, was there something that resonated for you and why? And I asked your table to pick one thing that you'd report out on. So I'm just going to remind you that we have microphones and we need people to go to the mic just to say that. There is no judgment call one way or the other. We're just going to have people comment on it. And I think that it's a helpful thing as well for the college to hear. So anyone can start. There are two mics, right? One over here and one here. Thank you. Brave and bold.
I don't know how we got to this comment, but this is what we ended up with, is some of the difficulties that we see in terms of regulation is when you're dealing with different bodies, some that have regulatory bodies and some that don't, and then dealing with ministries who come in and try and bring in their own sort of regulation. And that's sometimes in conflict with our own college, or it's not necessarily respecting what we are doing as, or our regulatory body is doing.
Okay. So in thinking about all of this, one of the challenges that you're talking about is the challenge where there's a conflict between different policies or different standards, and how does one reconcile that? Okay, great. Thanks. Other reflections?
Hi, what resonated for me from your talk was some catchphrases that you used, my title, your protection, and partners in quality care versus quality is up to you.
Thank you for that. Another, please.
Just to add to the previous comment, we also liked that catchphrase, my title, your protection, and we went on to talk about the power of the language and the emphasis of the language and how that can really change people's perception. And we could see, obviously, from what happened here for the PTs in Ontario and just how much power that had. So we talked about that. And the notion of improvement culture as opposed to the profession feeling that the regulatory body is the stick coming to possibly beat you, you know, if you've done something wrong. So we talked about how that notion, again, the language of improvement culture, that developing and moving forward, it's inspiring as opposed to this notion that they're there to come down hard on you.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Other things that resonated?
We really liked the phrase as well, the improvement culture, and I just loved your example about if the conversation at the work site or within the government is apples, then you talk about apples, but you have a creativity in terms of how you're planning to hope to move the conversation to something that you're really passionate about in terms of quality care. But that whole looking at everything as opportunities with a goal of improving the culture.
Yeah, super. Other tables.
Our table had a lot of discussion around the 27 regulatory bodies in BC or however number, and that we all have different standards and how, in terms of interdisciplinary practice, perhaps we need to start focusing on what the common ground is and bringing ourselves together as a common group so that when we sit down with our colleagues from different professions, we're speaking the same language instead of creating barriers with language.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's terrific because I often think, too, that it's so easy for us within the regulatory conversation to take a look at those pinch points and indicate that it's out there as opposed to, gee, maybe this is about us. We need to think about some of that. That's terrific. Thank you. Heather, please.
So we actually have the same perspective as Patty's table about language and how language influences perception. And the partnership to achieve safer practice was something that we talked about quite a bit. And just using occupational therapists as an example to partner with their clients and how we should use that approach as well to partner with our college.
Yeah, absolutely. Terrific. Any other thoughts that people want to share before I send you on your way with the next question?
Sorry, I already spoke, but one of the other conversations that we had that I forgot to mention was around the BCSOT and COTBC and sort of how can we partner more closely the two organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it's such an important thing, but it's a tricky thing.
So we're thrilled the fact that you're an occupational therapist to begin with. And really,
I am too, actually.
And the fact that you're able to relate some of the core skills as an OT and how that had enabled you to excel and become a leader in a big organization that is still part of your core grounding, so that being one. The second is the fact that you challenge us to have the insight to know what we don't know but not scare away from it, but understand that it is what the organization need or sometimes our facility, our department, you know, you can put a different frame on it, but knowing what they need, knowing that you may be the conduit to get that need even though you know zero about what's going on, and having the courage to take that step, because what that step is going to open up that next door, that next window, allow you to take the next step, and before you know it, you're in the midst of it, and you learn a whole lot. So I think often OTs are very humble, and we are very careful. We don't want to put ourselves out there because we don't know everything, and that's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for that very much. Absolutely. And I think that you raise a really interesting point because I'm reflective of this often. I think strong leadership is not absent of humbleness. Yeah. And so I think, and in fact, if you look at any of the literature on what they call level five leadership is not about ego. Anyway, interesting. Thank you for that. Any other thoughts? Okay, I need to go back to my cheat sheet just a second. Okay, let's notch this just a little bit differently here. So what I'd like you to focus on for the next area of discussion, and we've got one table of two over here, right? Would it be so awful to have you move and connect with a table that's got a little bit of space so you can expand the conversation for you? I hate to point that out, but it might just be a helpful thing for you too. Okay, so think a little bit about at your tables about where the opportunity for focus might be in public interest and the future. So if you're really thinking, okay, what have we been talking about? And when you're thinking about, and I take you back to even the topics on confidence, you know, and you had a whole bunch of ideas on what confidence looked like, and I'm not suggesting just to take you there. But if there was an opportunity for focus, and the focus is on public interest in the future, have your conversation and then pick one thing on what you would suggest would be a good place to start and why. Okay? So this is not about professions' interests. So this isn't about, you know, we'd like a whole new set of tiddlywinks or whatever. All right, so what we're now talking about is where would you see an opportunity for focus? Obviously on the public interest side of life and a future-oriented thing. If you had your druthers in an opportunity and based on the conversation at your table, what would you put out as the one idea for opportunity for focus?
At our table, what came up quite loud and clear was that because we have a mix of private practitioners and public practitioners, and the issue of consent and release of information, and how the college and BCSOT and the members can collaborate on communicating the importance of consent and release of information, where the public practitioners are not consistently using a consent and release of information and informing their patients, clients, that they can contact the regulatory body.
So the public member, the public hospital members need the carrots and the private people need the sticks? Is that the point? I'm teasing you.
We have to have a conversation about that metaphor. Because I don't... No, it's the importance of the release of information and consent. Yeah. That issue.
Yeah. No. I understand what you're saying. Good. Thank you for that. Okay. Next idea. Great. Thanks.
Our discussion was around the work that the regulatory body is doing with government organizations, especially when it comes to legislation that's been passed that's affected the OT role, and the importance of being at the table first to be able to speak to what OT can offer. Second piece would be the education of membership as to how that legislation is going to impact. And then public awareness as well, education of the public as to what the implications are for the public.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So looking at different levels of engagement related to the legislative activity. Okay. Terrific. Other ideas around opportunities for focus?
We went more sort of a process, and we discussed about safety and access to services, equal access to services, and from there we moved to, does the college have a role in the access to services? And it started a discussion about interprofessional practice and the issue of dysphagia. And so the conversation went to, if, say, the speech therapists have certain standards, should the occupational therapists have the same standards if they're in the similar area? And then I said, and I also know of dietitians who dabble in the area as well. And that, so no answers, but...
Terrific. Really, there's two things I'd say about that. One is the access question is a particularly thorny one, mm-hmm. and very, very difficult. And for every regulatory body that I've had involvement in, this question goes around the table often. The challenge with the access question on the regulatory side of the house is that almost always, at least from a government perspective, involves fees. And as soon as you've got funding in the middle of the conversation, not so great a place for the regulatory community to be, because remember we were talking about integrity
and perception.
It's a challenge. Absolutely. So that's an interesting point that you raise. The common standards piece is a really great example, and one of the easy places to start are some of the controlled acts pieces or areas of risk, which dysphagia is one of them. So interesting. Thank you for that.
Our table also had a similar conversation about public safety, and it was also about the role of educating in that process of public safety so that the public knows whether they're getting the best service provider. We had several examples, such as in the driving test, that they've had kinesiologists doing the test versus an OT. So the implications have been great for the clients because they've lost their ability to drive and what has been the follow-up. Whereas if they have, I guess what we're trying to say is that the college's role in educating and bringing about awareness as to what our competencies are and our services and our training and that kind of thing.
Yep. And coming in, the competency discussion as well, if we were putting stretch on it, is the interest in, remember I was talking a little bit about not so much silos and division of roles, but how you look at the buffet of what you're bringing to the table. I think it's a very interesting interprofessional conversation. And as an example, as the we've got a major scope of practice change in physiotherapy coming up in Ontario, and we're looking at working very closely with the College of Physicians and Surgeons to do a strategy on competency conversations so that family physicians in particular have an understanding of the competency set. We're not promoting the profession in the sense of you should refer to a PT. What we are saying, though, is here are the competencies you can count on, and here's what you get from the college if you're looking for information. So, yeah, it's interesting. Another thought, please.
Our table group went on a similar path in terms of this issue around the focus for the public. Is that importance around safety? So we had a bit of a dialogue around the public would like to know that they're moving forward and moving ahead with their goals around the area. And we had one example at our table around there's an increased focus on people living independently at home for longer periods of time. And the focus of government is on saving dollars. So how do you balance that and how do you prove that your OT is helping you to be more independent and providing you with safe, ethical care to be able to be independent in your home for longer. Yep. So we had a bit of a conversation around driving and then a little bit of a conversation around initiatives for people to be able to live independently. So that's where we went.
Yep. And those are excellent initiatives where you're looking at a collaborative between academia. So what's taught, what's happening in practice, and where's the evidence, which allows the conversation to be totally evidence-based, which is a really important one. Other thoughts?
I've got my hands just here because I want to say something about, I'm finding that there's a lot of mixing up, and I think we'd be very clear around promoting occupational therapy and why we're the best to be hired versus a regulatory position. And you all know I'm a BCSOT all the way, and I think that's huge. Yep. I mean, all I keep hearing is the scope of practice. Yes, we might be able to do it from a competency point of view, but how do we promote what we are the best to do it? Mm-hmm. That is your professional association. So I urge people to go and talk to your colleagues. When 1/3 of the population of OTs in this province only belong to the professional association, how are we going to get that word across? Mm-hmm. And I really want you to, I want that to be heard loud and clear. Yeah. So get your colleagues to join the professional associations.
Yeah, fair enough. And do you know what? That's such a great point. It's such a great point because a strong regulatory voice needs to be balanced with a strong professional association voice, for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Any other comments before I move you to the last question before we wrap up?
Our opportunity for focus, we thought, should be just informing the public about what we do as OTs. That's so important. This is a great start. And just to frame our practice as individuals when we're working with our clients and the importance of quality documentation with consent. That's our marketing tool, and we really need to put big emphasis on that because that is shared with our colleagues, with other agencies, and with individual clients. And so we felt that's really important.
Good. Thank you. Can I lead you into the last area of dialogue just before we break? And the question I'd like you to put your mind to a little bit is this whole question around engagement. So if engagement is key to strong self-regulation, and self-regulation is about self being individual, but the profession as a whole, what one new strategy would your table come up with around engagement? How to create conversation with the regulatory body? Okay, or what the regulatory body could be doing in order to assist in increasing engagement. Okay, people, I'm hearing a little bit of buzz. Do people understand what I'm asking? So if engagement, the two-way street, right? You've got a college, but a college is really about the body as a whole. What would you suggest if you were trying to yank up engagement more in terms of, what one strategy? Pardon me?
Engagement of OT.
Engagement of occupational therapists. Mm-hmm. Yep. Related to college activity. Okay, so we were talking about, you know what, you guys are a classic example of engagement, so it's perfect. But I'm wondering, in your discussions, are there ideas that you'd like to share that have come up related to engagement? Please, go ahead.
We'd like to applaud the college for their new launch of their website. Highly interactive and will, I think, engage members more. We're saying exploit web-based technology more, not necessarily social media. I do think you need to have some kind of monitoring of that and control, but podcasts, live meeting, other technologies where we can access our more rural remote therapists who are such a huge part of our profession here in this province.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other ideas on engagement?
We are kind of... In contrast to what Donna was saying, we were thinking that it's actually going to require the establishment of a formal campaign where the sites are going to have individual people who would be knowledgeable about the college, could inform workers at those sites, and then also kind of use the real experiences in the moment there to show the meaning and the utility of the college itself. Mm-hmm. We did also comment on the website and think that it's excellent to have that as a resource, but more as a secondary resource because you need to formalize connections between work sites first.
So it's the network piece. Great. Thank you. Hi, Heather.
I'm going to start by apologizing to Kathy and my board colleagues because they've heard this from me for quite a while. But I'm going to take the opportunity in the larger group. I think the college needs to work a little bit more with employers to support, and I'm not talking financially, their occupational therapists to become involved in the college, and if they are involved, to recognize that and applaud them, as opposed to not. If I may, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, good, thanks.
Hi, we were in support of the open forum and perhaps having like a date set, 6 p.m. on October 26th is going to be the meeting, and having a webcam present so that people could tap into it if they want, and then to be able to respond to the meeting in a blog format and have online surveys. I think I got it all. Those were the things we talked about. Yeah.
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you. Fabulous.
Our table really liked your idea, actually, of the physiotherapist network, where you're able to have, I think you said, 50 to 100 therapists that you consult with at the beginning when you're just talking about ideas and generating ideas and then wanting feedback. We thought that that would be an excellent forum for helping to engage therapists as well as get some information and understand what the professional body's opinions are before you go ahead with things so that you have a little bit more involvement of people.
Super, thanks. Any other additional thoughts before I bring this to a close?
Well, our table is, I guess, on the younger side, and so we absolutely agreed with sorry.
Was that compared to me?
I guess no. I shouldn't have said that, but I shall. But we absolutely agree with Donna's suggestion about doing much more online technology, and we strongly support like an online self-assessment tool. And in conjunction with a self-assessment, we felt that having something like CME credits would be a more rigorous way of evaluating our competencies and then submitting like a quiz or a survey at the end of it to show our competency in that area that we just did, you know, an education module or something on. So we're strongly in favor of doing much more online. I think that would increase access for a lot more dialogue across the board in rural or urban areas.
Okay. Great. Please.
Hi. Just from an employer perspective, a lot of our OTs who work are juggling home life and work life, and to be able to expect them to participate to a high level of outside work time education, I think sometimes is a bit unrealistic. So if we can actually provide work time for those individuals to participate, whether it be online or through podcasts or education events, then I think we really need to support those younger women in their careers.
Yeah, thank you for that. Are you going to take one more and then...
Sorry, I'll be quick. I just wanted to thank Kathy over the years because I think she is accessible by phone and she is very responsive to if you have an interest or a certain strength you want to share with the college or a way that you want to contribute. I think she's very good at creatively finding a way for you to contribute to the college. So
Thank you, Kathy. Perfect. That's a classic example of the one voice being a majority. So thank you. So just in terms of closing, you guys have been great in terms of just providing some spontaneity to ideas and sparking the thinking that I think really works to create a strong underpinning of conversation. And I'm just going to go back to what we started with just some of the key reflections. And I'm going to, and I'm not meaning to be too provocative about it in closing, but it's interesting as we've had this conversation, that there were some individuals, because you can always go to where the majority sits as well, but you can also look at the flip side of what it means too. And so when we asked the question and we took a look in the room where we were talking about leadership and knowing that the regulatory college was a leader, we had some individuals in this room who didn't know that. That's a question, I think, for reflection on what does that mean and how are we getting message out and what does that look like. I think generally speaking, across this room, individuals saw the opportunity for the college to be assisting with regulation and positioning. We've heard ideas here today that say maybe we can ante that up a little bit, keep it focused, but make a little bit of a difference in that way. When we looked at the whole concept of confidence, you in this room were amazing at articulating really quickly what that could look like. But where is the profession going around being able to really understand and really assist in a message out? That confidence is not only well-earned, but it's evident in the public community. So thank you for your reflections. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. And I really hope that this has just given you another way to look at regulation, its importance, its place in the profession, and its place as a partner in the quality and safety story. So thanks so much for your time.
And I'd just like to thank Jan very much for her enlightening presentation. And it's almost, for me, it's almost like the chicken and the egg. Do we regulate then lead, or do we lead to regulate? And on behalf of the college and everyone here, I would like to present you with that.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much again.
Thanks so much.